I must slumber. But when I awaken, we will rule this Staten Island. Yes!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 243 for the week of March 25th, 2019. I am Energy Vampire David T. Cole, blah, and I'm here with Staten Island Chamber of Commerce President Sarah D. Bunting. Trusting familiar Tara Arieto.
I can't wait to be a vampire 10 more years.
And LARPing virgin Nick Reinwell Jones.
1,000 hit points and zero charisma.
Everybody's really punchy today, so let's just get into it and hope this all works out. First, a little site business at the top. Thank you very much to all our supporters. We just hit, as of yesterday, our third goal.
What?
So that means in April, you'll be seeing three extra, extra hot, great episodes coming your way, including our first listener game time episode, which we're Woo! Planning on mid-month. Woo! Right now, we're just setting it all up, getting our contestants in. Invites are going out for that this week. There's only three spots, and we have like over 100 applicants. So just to temper your expectations
wow.
of getting into the first game, less than 3% will get in April. But we'll do a few more after that for sure. And that is site business.
We are here to talk about FX's series adaptation of What We Do in the Shadows. It does not premiere until tonight, if you're listening to this podcast the day it comes out. But we were... felt somewhat comfortable talking about it since it's based on a movie from 2014 that it's not super duper spoilable, but we will try to confine this conversation to the pilot. And we wanted to have as our guest someone who is a big fan of the Jemaine Clement / Taika Waititi oeuvre, like maybe so much that he would have seen the pilot already at one of its public screenings at Cannes. And so with that, we have returning champion Nick Reinwell Jones. Hey, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Yeah! So let's talk about movie versus TV show. Maybe give an overview of what the movie is and how the show conforms to and diverges from that story.
Oh, essay question. Okay, here we go. So the movie is a mockumentary about a group of vampires that live in a house together in New Zealand. Of course, New Zealand, since it was directed by Taika Waititi and written by Jemaine Clement, who of Flight of the Conchords, and it has a very Flight of the Conchords feel to it. It is the humor is very loose, and it is just kind of about the banality of these vampires' lives in I forget if it's is it Auckland? I
Wellington.
Can't remember where.
Yeah. Wellington. Yeah,
Wellington. Yeah, and you know, kind of the vampires' attempt to not get bored as they live eternal lives and, you know, eventually turn friends into vampires and so forth. And the TV version is that also, except it's a different group of vampires and it takes place in Staten Island / you know, Vancouver, where it was actually filmed.
Yes.
And I was like, what boring place is this that they filmed this in? Yes, Canada. Sorry.
Could have been actual Staten Island. Oh!
Yeah. And the show is, it's very similar, as far as I can tell from just the pilot, that, it's like real world style, these vampires living together and they have different personalities, and two of them are a couple. And the other two are, you know, kind of strange in their own ways. And one thing that is really striking about the show is that you can already tell that, like, the 30-minute pilot probably has about five times the budget that the movie did. Because there are, like, legit vampire special effects and everything that I wasn't even prepared for. Like, vampires actually turning into bats and, like, some really, like, slick stuff that is kind of works well with the, like, realistic mockumentary feel. But, so that's it in a nutshell, and I hope I got at least a B on that.
Yeah, that was excellent.
I think they did a pretty good job carrying the tone and feel of the movie over to TV. I'm really happy they kept the credits of the movie. Like, they just basically swapped out the, you know, photos and documents thing with the Staten Island vampire stuff, and the song is the same, the title treatment is the same, And it really signals that this is an extension of the movie. They're not doing a really crappy TV reimagining. Although I think at times, maybe it's a little too good at carrying the tone over. It's very familiar, as it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you are really into the movie, the pilot seems a little staid. Mm-hmm. The genius of the movie is, as Nick says, this banality of three or four supernatural guys living in a mansion and all the weird shit they get into or don't get into. And if you haven't watched the movie, What We Do in the Shadows, the pilot provides you with that. If you have watched it, you lose that discovery.
Yeah, it even starts with a house meeting the same way that the movie does, where they're just going over very, you know, kind of mundane stuff.
So I think if you are a fan of the movie, like most people on today's episode are, I think what you'll enjoy about the show is the additions, the changes they have made from the movie. And chief among them is this concept of this other type of vampire, which is not sort of your Night Stalker typical gothic bloodsucker. Is this guy called an energy vampire, and he is basically your sort of worker drone guy. And the way that he operates is he steals energy from you by being the most boring guy in the world. Like, that character could actually probably do a crossover into Office Space, if you imagine it.
Yes.
It, there's a Venn diagram between these two properties. And yes, that is great. And later on in the series, he has like even more to do as the series goes on. And that's what I really gravitated to in the pilot, just because I've seen the movie like 10 times, you know, so I know all mm-hmm. those beats. Not that they don't do the beats right in the show at all. Like, I think they're very faithful. Obviously, the creators are involved, and it's just that it's territory you've already, you know, been across.
Yeah, and the energy vampire is played by Mark Proksch, from who has a recurring role on Better Call Saul as the weird bald drug guy
/ baseball card collector. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And he is really funny when he gets his breakout episode. I agree with Dave. I think he's the best addition of the series. And I would also add, until recently, you could watch What We Do in the Shadows, the movie, on Prime for free if you were a Prime subscriber. But they just, in time for this show to come out, yanked it, so now you can only buy or rent it. Boo.
Those bastards.
Sarah, what did you think of this as a Staten Island adjacent American?
Adjacent.
Yeah, well, yes. Hello, fellow residents of the congressional district. That, I think, made me laugh the hardest that they were there. Just because, sure. Like, Staten Island is a sort of staid suburban place, but also is like a really weird, like, Brooklyn through the looking glass place. So that just was perfect and made me laugh. I've never seen the movie, but my issue with what I have seen of this, which was just the pilot, was this. It seemed like it was perfectly suited for a feature length mockumentary film. And did not need to be a series. Like, I liked it. I laughed a bunch of times. It was clever. The bit where the tablet won't register their signatures. And
yeah, I thought,
like,
that was really funny.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, yeah, been there. Perhaps I am also a vampire. Blah. But I couldn't help thinking, like, I think this already existed in the medium that it's like peak medium. The other problem is that they were advertising this relentlessly during NCAA basketball, which I was watching relentlessly the last few days. And I was really concerned that it was going to be one of those, like, everything funny was in the ads. And, like, I did laugh at the ads every time, like every time that skeleton was set on fire in the drugstore, I giggled. But again, this did seem like superfluous in a way, but I don't know. Like, I'm not sure I'm going to keep watching, but I'm also not sure that I have enough information to keep watching, and maybe I should just rent the movie.
It's totally worth watching. I feel like
really
this
funny.
Is to the movie as CSI New York was to CSI Vegas. It's, you know, the same shtick in a different town. We're talking a lot about how it's a lot like the movie and the pilot. I will say there is elements that they introduce in subsequent episodes that do broaden the scope of what the vampires have to do. Like they are charged with a quest of sorts by sort of their vampire king, who's played by the same dude who plays the alien in Star Trek Discovery, as Tara told me, which is this guy is basically the Andy Serkis of TV.
Right? I was just going to say
It's Doug Jones.
Doug Jones,
Also from The Shape of Water and everything else.
Yeah, and, you know, they go into Manhattan for an episode, and that's kind of fun. It's a pilot, right? It's not nearly as, it's not the Office US pilot where they did a note for note, terrible reenactment of the English one. They set the tone and they put it in Staten Island, right? I mean, that's sort of this. And they're slowly iterating on the formula, I think. I like the I like that there's a lady vampire in the house now. Laszlo, is that his character's name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They could lose him. He's a real, they haven't figured out what to do. His character is dull. They need to sharpen that character and figure out what he's doing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Nick, final thoughts? Are you going to keep watching?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you were kind of circling around is like there's making it into a series, like even if it's going to be mostly rely on being funny, like you have to invest in the characters in, to a certain extent. And I think like what worked about it being a movie is that these characters are just like so crazy that like you enjoy just like hanging out with them for an hour and a half and then discarding them. Mm. And, you know, even if the show is going to get by on laughs, and I think, you know, and it has a lot of laughs, you know, to have this feel like, you know, the vampire version of The Office, like on The Office, you know, eventually, you know, yeah, it didn't start out great character wise, but you eventually like really invested in those characters despite how crazy they were. And I think this show is going to have a more uphill battle with that because it's like, they're so ridiculous. And, you know, you've like, there is no kind of like emotional reality to it. They're not really trying for that. So, yeah, I don't know what it would look like, you know, a couple seasons in, like, are they going to try to bring it to a more grounded place somehow? I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like they're foregrounding the Guillermo character, who is one of the vampire's familiars. And, you know, there was a similar familiar character in the movie as well, who's like just been waiting around to be turned into a vampire. And that's why she put up with so much shit. And Guillermo, same thing. But he seems like he has a much bigger part here. And I don't know if like that's supposed to be our in. Like,
it was not for me. I was kind of like every time Guillermo was on screen, I was like, why is Guillermo on screen? I mean, it's a funny concept, but yeah, like if that's what they're trying to get me to invest in, like they're barking up the wrong tree.
He's kind of like the human character in All My Circuits on Futurama, where like he lives, he learns human stuff. Anyway, sorry, Dave, you were going to say.
I was only going to say, I think they are going in the direction Nick is saying, not with the familiar, but there is an arc, and this is spoiler free, but there's an arc involving the female vampire and female empowerment coming a couple episodes now that I think is leading the way to both diverging from the source material, but also sort of humanizing, as it were, you know, the players in the show. And it's an interesting, where they're going with it seems interesting.
Yep, I agree.
It's time to go around the dial. Our first stop, Tara Ariano.
Well, oh boy. I watched NBC's latest retread of This Is Us, which does the impossible by being even shittier than A Million Little Things. It's called The Village. Wow, it's so bad. So it's exactly This Is Us, except it takes place in New York. The Village is the name of this apartment building where all of the characters live. And that's like, you know, that's the connective tissue, as it were. And it's so by the numbers, like it's impossible to watch it and not feel how much you're being cynically pandered to. There's a nurse who works in a nursing home, and she has a teen daughter that she had very young, and now the daughter's pregnant. There's like brief discussion of abortion, but then like that's quickly thrown out the window because it's network TV. And there's a returning soldier who has an amputation, and he's moving into the building, and it's a walk up, wah wah. He's subletting an apartment from this gay couple that's teaching overseas, and they are so saintly that we find out they will not take rent for their place. Like, Frankie Faison is the building manager. He also owns a bar, and he's like, you know, takes him through and is really trying so hard to make him feel like this is really a family, like no building I have ever been in New York or anywhere else. Like, yeah. That's not a thing. That's not real. And it also does the This Is Us thing where, like, not until the end do you find out how people are connected and stuff. So there's also a good cop character who you can tell he's good because ICE agents are menacing this, you know, woman of color. And he's like, hey, leave her alone. And then they're like, we have a warrant. And he's like, oh, OK, my bad. Like, no, that doesn't make you a good guy. You're still a dick.
And you haven't even mentioned the junior from Soprano.
And Junior from Sopranos is an old guy who lives in the nursing home and is trying to get his grandson, who's the stupid piece of shit impregnator Ricky from The Secret Life of the American Teenager, also a law student. He's trying to get his grandson to let him move in with him. Like, I was so mad the whole way through. And then when I thought it was over at the 45 minute mark, and then I was so furious that there was still a whole other act to get through.
Can I just explain the one scene that I saw that I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah. Dave was looking at wallpaper while I was watching this, like, to give you an idea of what's more interesting.
Junior saw service and his friends were in the service at some point, and they meet the amputee soldier that Tara was talking about. And they do that thing where the new soldiers sort of down the dump. So the old veterans, they come up and they start saluting them. They're like, blah, 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 from the 101 Airborne. Thank you for your service. And they all do that in order around the table. And it was just like, oh, come on, guys. What is this? What is this show?
Speaking of World War II, it really feels starting to feel like the networks are like those people on the islands that were still fighting World War II like 20 years later. Like, it's like not only are they not trying to compete with like Netflix and stuff, I'm not sure they're aware that those things exist. Like,
totally. Yeah. I mean, I know that This Is Us is a huge hit, but like there's only so many Xeroxes you can make of it. And even, I feel like even This Is Us people don't talk about anymore. Like, it kind of had its moment and then it sort of faded out. And this is, it's so cynical and dumb. And, you know, Dominic Chianese obviously deserves better. Lorraine Toussaint, who's also this Frankie Faison's wife, she deserves better. He deserves better. Michaela McManus, briefly an ADA on SEU, she doesn't deserve better and is still terrible. And
I always liked her.
All right. So in conclusion, there's Tartikoffs in the jungle that don't know network TV. It's
no.
Yeah. Don't watch The Village Tuesday nights on NBC. For my plug, I am on The Blotter Presents this week, talking about a much better show. We discussed The Act, the new Hulu adaptation of the Dee Dee and Gypsy Blanchard true crime story. And I think we had a very good discussion, even though we were super punchy recording that one, too. So we'll yes, see. Good true. Luck editing that one, Sarah. But anyway, it was...
Nope. You were a delight, as always. We also discussed a history detectives in which the question, was this America's first serial killer, was asked 28 times. Spoiler, no. But it's a fun episode, and it should be available as you're listening to this, wherever fine podcasts are not sold.
Can you tell us who was the first serial killer in America?
I can't.
No.
Nick.
Okay, well, since I'm behind on TV and I definitely haven't watched anything that hasn't already been discussed on this show, I thought I would talk about something I saw in real life a couple of nights ago, because I know that there are a lot of fans on this show and in the audience of Playing House, and I had a chance to see Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham do improv at UCB, thanks to a hot tip from my friend and friend of the show, Laura Nell. We went to see this show that was supposed to be they called it Jess and Len and Friends. And then they came out and they were like, we forgot to invite any friends. So it's just the two of us. And it was just the two of them doing improv for an hour based on suggestions. It was exactly as fantastic and delightful as you would imagine.
Oh, man. I bet.
Some questions you may have. Did it involve Jessica's character forcefully wrestling Lennon's character to the ground to put her into a therapeutic holding position? Yes, it did. did they do an entire bit about the Kanye, Kim, Kenny G Valentine ending with Jessica's character farting Kenny G music? Yes, it did. did Lennon portray a serial killer so effectively that Jessica broke character to say she was getting freaked out? Yes. And it ended with an audience Q&A where they talked about how doing Best Friends Forever literally almost killed them. because they didn't understand the concept of work-life balance, and they both ended up going to the ER. As soon as it was canceled, Lena decided to get pregnant. Jessica felt betrayed because she wasn't ready to get pregnant yet, but then she was doing the movie Enough Said with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus just offhand asked her, like, so when are you getting pregnant? And she was like, what? I don't know you. But she was like, no, I'm not ready. My career isn't there yet. And she said that Julia said, I'm roughly paraphrasing, like, oh, what, are you going to be bummed out about missing a chance to do a guest spot on Gary Unmarried? And she said, you know, good point. Okay. And then she basically got pregnant the next day, and then she went on Veep and told Julia that she was doing it, and she was like, I don't know if I did the right thing. And Julia said, don't worry, like, if you don't want the baby, just drop it off on my doorstep and I'll raise it as my own.
Oh my god, I love her so much. That's amazing. Yeah,
so all in all, a great evening. I don't know how often they do this, or but the show is called Jess and Len, if you're not, you know, if you're kind of scanning the UCB LA listings or New York, because I know they do it sometimes there too. Well worth seeing. A great night, and you really saw that they are like absolutely the best friends, and also now their daughters are best friends, which is,
oh my god. Aww. I love it. Before you do your plug, I will also just mention, since this is as good as time as any, Playing House is finally available to stream for free. There is a streaming service you've probably never heard of called IMDb Free Dive from the IMDb. And okay, that is where, that's where you can find it.
Why wouldn't they put it on Amazon Prime? Is this,
yeah, because Amazon owns IMDb anyway. Like, that's,
you know, it so might silly. Be on Prime as well. That's all. That's the information that I have from from Just Watch. I will research that while Sarah is doing her thing. Go ahead.
I'm only your memory. Plug. I cannot provide any more information. Okay. For plugs, also, I really only have real life stuff to plug. So if you are in Los Angeles, if you are familiar with the Hollywood Fringe Festival, which is a theatrical festival that happens every June, in which people put on all kinds of crazy plays and stuff. I have a short immersive show that will be part of that festival. It is called The Pod. It is a sci-fi immersive show for one person at a time. We kind of call it a emotional space mountain. So
turns out it was man.
Wow.
That will start in about mid-June. So I, if you, we have an Instagram presence for that at Pod Immersive. I'll link to that. And then also coming this November to Los Angeles as well, Safe House 82, the sequel to my immersive show, Safe House 77, Ooh. Which I did a couple of years ago. We jump 5 years into the future, and lots more spy stuff is happening. So stay tuned for that via my social media presences. And yeah, that's it for me.
Amazon IMDb Free Dive is included with your Amazon Prime subscription.
Sorry, I don't know what's going on anymore.
No,
Sarah D. Putney.
Punjola. Hello. The Good Fight is back on CBS All Access, which is not included with Amazon or IMDb.
No.
Yet, but eventually we're all going to get sucked into one giant Borg, I hope. Because I have so many fucking passwords. Anyway, The Good Fight. Yay. It is back. I always forget how nice it is to be back around these people.
Yeah.
Truly. Just like competent, rage-filled, hilarious, extremely enviably dressed women, mostly. And, you know, Gary Cole and Delroy Lindo. I love the Good Fight shorts that they do, like the little Schoolhouse Rocky little shorts about legal terms. The NDA one was stuck in my head for like 2 days. This season they are taking on various Trump's America issues with the usual thoughtful fury. And the season premiere in particular was a masterstroke of casting. It featured the great Regina Taylor, who was in, among many other things, a couple of Law and Orders. The first one, which she's notable for just winding up and delivering one of the great parent-child,
oh God,
the slaps,
mm-hmm,
in TV history. But the one people mostly remember, I imagine, was one about a woman who was blackmailed into sleeping with her boss and then was raped by her boss and said nothing so that she could stay on the partnership track at her law firm. And she is guest starring as a victim of sexual coercion by the late Carl Reddick, who used to be the head of the firm and played the father of the character played by the great Audra McDonald. She has a scene when she's watching a video of Regina Taylor breaking down about this. And it's just like, I mean, it's an acting masterclass. every week, but also is fun and really proves that when you like, it is possible to spin off a series into something more, into a more like prestige-y environment, I guess, and not only, you know, they're not only adding like nudity and boobs. Mm-hmm. Like there's, I mean, there's more to it than that. And the way that they've done this and taken some of the best characters and proceeded forward in a thoughtful and entertaining way, is really great. And as always, the fashion is always, and, they're going in a new curly direction with the famous Lockhart coif, and I'm here for it. So that is Thursdays on CBS All Access, and find your passwords and join me. I had planned to plug my wife being on The Blotter Presents, but she took mine. So I will note that again with this, Beverly Hills 90210 edition is slowly transitioning into, again with this, Melrose Place edition.
Yay.
Next Monday will be the pilot of Melrose with all the paper bag waste jeans or Amy Locane you could possibly want and less.
So bad.
Oh God, it's so bad. Where is that accent from?
It's supposed like to be South Carolina, but it's like
a string of firecrackers at a Klan meeting. That was probably too far. Probably a little too far.
No. All that. No, it's not. At all.
Anyway, so we're doing that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have two foreign comedies to talk about. First up, This Time with Alan Partridge, or is it just called This Time?
I think it's This Time with Alan Partridge.
It's always with Alan Partridge.
Yeah, it's true. It kind of circles back to the format of the first series where he has a talk show on networked television. And this time, you know, he has the non-experience of the past 15 years backing him up. It is available through Methods. So,
England.
I like the real world versions of the series better.
You mean the ones that are more sitcom-y? Like this is very much, we're just watching like a half hour news magazine broadcast, basically.
Yes, the ones that follow him around in real life, mm-hmm. the radio years, I guess. But this one has got a lot to recommend for it. I think if you can handle the cringe comedy, which kind of feels all the more cringier because Alan continues to be needy and terrible, even though he's kind of succeeding in his career now, you know, like even though he has achieved somehow against all odds, some measure of success, he is still that same terrible, needy person. And some of the stuff he does on the show is truly cringy. Like if you can't watch the UK Office, you can't watch this.
I think it's the first episode where he's interviewing a woman who's a documentarian, and he keeps calling her, he keeps saying her last name Clunt, and it's Fluck. And then he just keeps going, oh, I see what I did there. And he does it every time. Like, he's an idiot. And the other funny thing about it is that he initially is just filling in for a guy who's having a health crisis, who's the regular co-host of the show. And the female co-host who's there every week clearly hates Alan and is like trying to make the best of it. But then the guy he's replacing is not coming back. And there's like some kind of very timely at the BBC references to like misconduct that he did. And Alan actually gets to be right about that, which is kind of interesting because it happens so rarely. It's mostly just a ridiculous news broadcast show with Alan fucking up in like a variety of novel ways and ways that you're familiar with. But yeah, it's really funny.
Yeah. My other show, and it's kind of neat that Nick is here, is a show called Get Kraken, which is the follow up to the catering show that Nick introduced us to. A while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad to return the favor, Nick. This time the two Kates have a morning show called Get Kraken. And it's a few things. It's a spoof of the insipid morning programming that, you know, has invaded television the past 20 years. It is a comedic commentary on career women and gender roles and a few other social issues that they bring up. And three, most importantly, it's a lot of general stupidity that you come to expect from from those two. It is really funny. If you watch the catering show and liked it, you're going to love this, too. There's one season on Netflix. Is that correct?
No, the first season is on iTunes, so it's only for purchase. And the second season is currently, it is ending in Australia this week. So if you can fly to Australia, you can get it. But yeah, the premise of the first season is the only time slot they could get is at 3 a.m. So they're like, it's like Hoda and Kathy Lee at 3 a.m. And the idea is like it's being simulcast in the U.S. where like over there it's mid-morning. So it makes a little more sense. But they like try to do all the usual, you know, stupid, gimmicky morning show stuff, like let's go to our window, except it's 3 a.m. and like the only person there is like masturbating against the glass and stuff. Like if you, and they do so much funny stuff with their chyrons, and like they just everywhere they can replace a C with a K, they do, because they're both Kates, including like places where it makes no sense, they'll just put a K at the end of a word, and like, yeah. it's super ridiculous. And I would also say, if you like the catering show, of course you will like this, but if you like Reductress, the website that's like the Onion meets Jezebel, basically, you will like Get Kraken too. It's super fun.
I think also, like, if you like Full Frontal or Broad City too, that you'll like this too.
Yes,
I was trying to call up, there was one chyron, and I'm just going to call it up in real time on my phone, that I put on Instagram, science alert, and that science SK, scientists confirmed jazz is bullshit, reads one of the comments.
Wow, they're really pandering.
Yeah.
Fine, I'll watch it. Jesus.
Ooh, I'm excited.
We are continuing to also fly to England to watch Taskmaster. We are up to series 4, which, if you're following along, features Lale Adefope, who is from Shrill and also has a recurring role in This Time as well. But anyway, a couple of weeks ago when Will Leash was here, we had an extra credit about Taskmaster, and my imagined tasks were create a domino course, I think I called it. I guess it's a domino rally, which I forgot at the time. And the other was make a shirt out of Post-its. And in season 3, both of those happened. So someone had tweeted to us about the prescience of some of the ideas that we had. But yeah, both of those did occur. So I guess I will be here waiting for my invitation to join the writing staff of Taskmaster, because somehow I knew those were good ideas.
It is time for the canon. Tara Ariano is submitting this week. What's the word?
Is here.
Take it away, Tara.
Punch, punch, punch. Hi. I am presenting an episode that's been on my to canon list since I happened to catch it on the Hallmark Channel sometime last fall. It is Frasier Season 2, Episode 3, The Matchmaker. The episode just has one storyline, so let's go through how each of its elements demonstrates what makes it a canon contender. Number one, it reminds us that Daphne has, or at least aspires to have, a life outside of Frasier's apartment. Everyone in the household is awakened in the middle of the night by a smoke alarm. The Cranes are panicking as they try to find the fire, but then Daphne runs out, having turned it off. It was the alarm over her bed, and she claims not to know what could have set it off, but then Eddie, the fucking cop, tears into the room with a package of Marlboros in his mouth. That is a strangely sensitive fire alarm, but okay. Daphne knows Frasier forbids smoking in the apartment, but occasionally she'll have one to steady her nerves, and though she initially pretends not to want to talk about it, Daphne does confide in Frasier about what's bothering her in clip 1.
No, you need your sleep. It's nothing important. Just this feeling that my life's a gaping sinkhole and I'm just marking time while the flower of me youth rots on the vine.
Well, so long as you're sure. Really wish you'd tell me about it.
Well, if you must know, it's me love life.
Really? You've been seeing a man?
Only when I close my eyes and concentrate.
I see you're going through a bit of a drought, eh?
Small wonder. The rare times I do go out, it's usually with your father. People see us and assume I'm his daughter or else his girlfriend. Either way, it's like having my own personal can of stud repellent.
Frasier's attempts to buck her up involve him telling his own stories of times he felt unlovable in Boston, only to have met first Diane and then Lilith, who then each ended up breaking his heart. Daphne lights another smoke midway through his accidentally depressing story, which he then takes a drag off to take us out of the cold open, unclippable, but some very nice and subtle physical acting from both performers. Number two, it reminds Frasier that judging Roz has consequences. When Frasier tells Roz the next day that he was up late consoling a lonely Daphne, Roz is eager to help by passing on one of the exes in her bullpen. She's got an aerobics instructor named Sven and a runway model named Gunter, just for starters. Niles joins them mid-conversation, and when he realizes the subject is Daphne, specifically getting Daphne laid, it gets kind of ugly in clip two.
Dear God, Frasier, Sven, Gunther, Brick, why not just lather Daphne up with baby oil and hurl her over the wall of a prison yard?
Excuse me, but I've dated all these guys.
Well, where do you think I came up with the imagery?
Listen, you little titmouse.
All right, now listen, Niles. You are completely out of line here. And Roz, he does have a point. You and Daphne are entirely different kinds of women. While Daphne is very shy and inexperienced, you are more, well, a lot more. Well, actually, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's more...
Oh, I get it. Not one man I've ever dated is good enough for Miss Daphne. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, that is what I'm trying not to say. You're not making it very easy.
Oh, I'm out of here.
Oh, Roz, please,
no,
wait.
No, I can't stay. The fleet is in.
Roz's bad mood continues through their show that afternoon. She is in her booth when Frasier gets a visit from Tom Duran, KACL's new station manager, played by guest star Eric Lutz. Their small talk turns to Tom's last job, which was in London, where his ex still lives. The breakup doesn't sound like it was mutual, but Tom has a thing for the English, particularly those who are a little eccentric. Perceiving an opportunity, Frasier invites Tom over for a casual dinner at his place. Roz then counts Frasier back in, and Tom comes around to chat with her in clip three.
Well, you know, it's the same every job I take. Word spreads like wildfire.
Oh, what's that?
Oh, you know, you tell one or two people you're gay, and before you can blink, it's all over the station.
Well, they don't call it broadcasting for nothing.
They're not paying attention.
He seems like a nice guy.
Oh, he's okay.
Well, I hope he's more than okay. He just asked me out on a date.
Frasier just asked you out on a date.
Yeah, well, he asked me to his place for dinner. So I wanted to ask you, is there any particular wine he likes?
Well, listen, Tom, there's something you need to know about Frasier.
What?
Frasier holds up a sign that says, hands off, he's taken.
He's nuts about Chardonnay.
So Frasier could have avoided all the trouble that ensues if he hadn't treated Roz like an ungovernable man-eater. Oh, well. Number three. All the farcical misunderstandings regarding Tom keep Frasier the butt of the joke. From here, the writing in the episode is razor sharp so that the viewer buys that neither Tom nor Frasier figures out the other's intentions. In fact, from Tom's perspective, Frasier is being pretty forward in clip four.
So, what do you think of the place?
It's a hell of a view.
It's even better from the bedroom.
Why don't we just start with a drink?
The two also get into whether it limits Frasier's romantic pursuits to share the apartment with Martin. Frasier jokes that his biggest concern is Martin's tendency to try to steal Frasier's dates. And later, as far as Tom can tell, this appears to be true in clip five.
Yeah, let me tell you, you're going to love Seattle. It's a real people place. Good food, great bars.
I've heard that. Any you recommend?
Yeah, I usually hang out at a place called Duke's. Great crowd, a lot of young cops. Mm. So, you like football?
Oh, yeah, I really missed it when I was living in London.
Yeah, well, maybe we could take in a Seahawk game sometime. Frasier hates us, or it'd just be us.
Hey, Frasier warned me about you.
Niles then invites himself over to chaperone Daphne on her date and is predictably hostile toward Tom, so much so that Tom pulls him aside to ask if Niles has a problem with Tom dating his brother. Niles has barely had a chance to respond before Frasier angrily retrieves Tom to give him more time with Daphne. We don't get to see Niles tell Martin how badly Frasier has misread the situation, but we do hear Martin's cackle. Tom, confused by how many people seem to be on his date with Frasier, tries to clarify things, but it doesn't work in clip six.
She's quite a woman, isn't she?
Yeah, she's really something. Mm-hmm. Frasier, I was wondering.
Yes?
Do you think before the evening's over we could get a little one-on-one time?
Oh, I think I can arrange that.
Daphne! He says he wants to be alone with you.
No!
Yes!
So Daphne takes off to freshen her lipstick. Martin says goodnight, and when Frasier walks Niles out, the truth is revealed in clip seven.
There's something I have to tell you. Dad wanted to, but I won the coin toss.
Yes, what is it?
I had a little chat with Tom in the kitchen, and he told me he's interested in pursuing a romantic relationship, but the object of his affections is not Daphne.
Damn, that Roz!
No. It's you.
Me? Well, that's impossible. Tom's not gay.
He seems to be under that impression.
This episode aired in October 1994, a time when positive, non-stereotypical pop culture representations of gay characters were uncommon. This episode's writer, Joe Keenan, who is gay, pulled off something pretty rare, not just for that era, but for ours as well. He wrote an episode about a gay character misinterpreting a dinner invitation without ever, for one second, making the gay character ridiculous. There's only one fool here, and it's Frasier. Number four, it makes a meta point about how queer these characters actually are. Take it, Frasier, clip eight.
What on earth could have made him think that I was interested in him? All I did was ask him if he was attached, and then we talked about the theater and men's fashions. Oh, my God.
So now Frasier has to walk into a seduction scene and delicately disentangle himself without offending his boss or souring their professional relationship, which he does, but Tom makes some strong points in the process, starting in clip nine.
I'm sorry, but we seem to have gotten our lines crossed here. The truth is, I'm entirely straight.
Hey, if you're not interested, just say so.
No, it's true. I really am. I just invited you to dinner because you seemed so charming and you were so fond of the British. I thought you might be the perfect man for Daphne.
Oh, I can't believe this. You really had no idea that I'm gay?
So that long laugh is the audience reaction as Daphne walks back in, hears the end of this, whips off her lucky bra without breaking stride, and heads back out again. Obviously, also unclippable for our purposes, but again, a great moment of physical comedy. And the conversation continues in clip 10.
Don't take this wrong, but it never even occurred to me that you might be gay.
Well, it never even occurred to me that you might be straight.
Even with one foot out the door, Tom still can't quite believe that none of the Crane boys is gay in our final clip.
Does this mean your dad's not gay either?
No, dad's not gay.
But Niles, come on.
No, I'm afraid not. Huh.
So wait a minute, this Maris guy he kept mentioning is a woman?
Well, the jury's still out on that one.
I already mentioned the episode's gay writer, Joe Keenan. David Hyde Pierce, who played Niles, wasn't out to the public at this time, but one may be fairly sure he was out to his colleagues on the production, as was the late John Mahoney, who played Martin. Kelsey Grammer isn't, as far as we know, but I love that one of the first things producers wanted to do in the show's second season was hang a lantern on the show's queerness by having Tom come in and make what are, honestly, some pretty reasonable assumptions about why Frasier has a favorite custom tie shop in London or Martin frequents a bar that caters to young cops. Anyway, this episode is funny as hell, and whereas the gay plots of most sitcoms of this era, or even episodes that aired 10 years later, Friends, have aged so poorly that everyone who had any part in making them should be very embarrassed, The Matchmaker is unassailable on pretty much every level, and I hope you will agree and induct it into the canon. And let's start with Nick, who picked it from our list of submissions.
So yeah, I'm a huge fan of Frasier. Frasier is maybe my number one source of TV comfort food. If I'm just feeling like really exhausted and worn out, like I will just pop Frasier on Netflix and watch a bunch. I hadn't watched this particular one in a while, so it was very delightful to revisit it. And I was wondering going into it, because I didn't remember all of the jokes in it, did they kind of like go the gay panic route for comedy? And they really don't, to their credit. Like, there is not a single gay panic joke in this episode. Even though, like you say, it was very, it was like one of the most common shticks in sitcoms of that era. Like the, you know, there's nothing, not that there's anything wrong with an episode of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think they nailed it, and it really has aged beautifully, as a lot of Frasier episodes have, I think. I will say that years after this, they did sort of go the gay panic route on Frasier with when he has the, like the sex dream about Gil.
Oh yeah.
Not like the worst example of it ever, but like definitely they sort of went there later.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But in this one they don't. And yeah, I think it's some of my favorite small bits of physical comedy. One of course, Daphne tossing off the much vaunted strapless bra. And then also I just love like the micro moment that I maybe love more than almost anything else in this whole series is when Frasier says, "We're trying to find a man for Daphne," just like Niles's like facial twitch immediately when that happens before he even says anything is perfect. So yeah, this episode is packed with greatness, and thank you very much, Tara, for presenting it.
Shall I go next?
Sure.
This was a delight. It made me realize that I really have to watch all of Frasier, basically. The point that you make about it sort of existing out of its time in terms of the subject matter, like I didn't quite realize why I was doing this, but like everyone has that floppy 90s hair.
Yeah.
I mean, except Niles, who has like his usual, you know, floppy hair, and Frasier, who has like the floppy balding mullet. But
yeah,
I kept being like, why hasn't anyone updated their look? Like, why is everyone's hair so fucked up? And it's like, oh right, it is actually 94 in this timeline still. Pretty much everything I wrote down, you clipped. That exchange with Roz is like, sometimes Roz, I think, gets sold out a little bit by the writing as having to sort of exposition you into whatever is happening. But her delivery of "listen, you little titmouse" is fantastic. Like, that whole exchange is great. I like that this show celebrates like these sort of egghead pursuits of theirs and never sells the characters out, even the guest characters. So I like that about it. And John Mahoney's delivery, like my favorite moment in the whole episode, which overall is paced extremely well. And like the quick cut to Daphne taking off her bra, the way that she hits the lighter right at a certain point in Frasier's like litany of romantic misery. But my favorite moment is a perfectly timed, very short cutaway to Niles and Martin guffawing in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's just so like, if it were any longer, it would have been a little too much, but they're totally silent movie, like knee slapping in there. Like, I mean, so funny.
It's like when you were a kid and you get a glimpse in the adult world, like you're at, they're having a party at your house and you kind of crawl and you kind of just catch something happening, you know, through doorways, and it's sort of like a magical glimpse into something, and it's fleeting.
Yeah. And you do sort of wonder what they were saying to each other, like the actors, like what peas and carrots joke they exchanged to have that happen. Like it's really just like, it's delightful. And
yeah, you can imagine too, that there was a version of the script where we got to see them have that conversation. Mm. But the fact that it's like, it's just the laugh of reaction is so much better and funnier.
And the way Niles delivers it, like it would be very tempting to be hammy in that moment, but that this character really would be genuinely relieved that Daphne is like not in play with this other guy is like, it's played perfectly. The show is really so smart and just paced flawlessly. Like, they really have an ear for their characters and what they're doing. So this was a delight. Thanks, Tara.
Yeah.
So that kitchen scene was the last thing that I struck off that everybody else had already talked about that I wanted to say about why this is a good episode. So Well done, everybody. So let me just take another tact on this just to kind of place it in historical context and why this is sort of an outlier and worthy of canon, the canon.
Canon tree.
Canon tree. We're at this household rewatching Scrubs, something to watch at the end of the day and fall asleep to, basically. And it's around the same time-ish, more or less, in the geological sense of it. And
well, it premiered 7 years after this episode aired.
Even more so. Boy, that show is just full of gay panic stuff, Scrubs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I'm not even exaggerating. 15 to 20% of the jokes in Scrubs so far into season 3 or 4, whatever we're watching, I think are gay panic jokes of some sort or another. And that takes place after this episode.
Yeah.
It doesn't age nearly as well as Frasier did, you know, because you go back and watch it after not having watched it for 10 years. You're like, oh, boy, where was my brain 10 years ago? It's interesting to see the milestones on gay representation in TV kind of in your own lifetime as you sort of rewatch these shows from not so long ago. And to the compare and contrast Frasier and Scrubs, it was just like, oh, wow. I mean, when Tara put this up there and, you know, it was featured a gay character, I'm like, all right, mid-90s gay character. I think I know what this is going to be. It's going to be kind of like Three's Company, you know, 1994. But it wasn't. Kudos for Frasier for doing that. And it wouldn't be canon worthy if it also wasn't funny, which it is. You got physical moments. You got great jokes. You got the the ending of the Roz and Fleet Week joke, which was a great button on that. So, yeah. So I'm definitely going to say yes to this one. And woo! Nick, what say you?
Oh, definitely yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, yeah.
That means Frasier, and I don't know, I'm Frasier. Season 2, Episode 3, The Matchmaker, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week.
I have adopted this cat, named her Emily Dickinson. Oh. Named her Emily Dickinson.
This isn't really new news. This show was announced about a year ago, but Apple just had its, what is its Apple thing
Apple
called?
TV Plus. Terrible name.
No, but what is their, the whole thing? If that wasn't, it wasn't a part of a larger Apple announcement, it's just for Apple TV Plus.
I don't know what you're saying.
Scrap.
No. I thought it was, I know Apple
the
has
service
like their
in
big...
which you can get these TV shows is called Apple TV Plus.
Okay, I thought it was part of like Apple's annual. Here's all our hardware that we're.
No, it was all just about all this bullshit stuff that's not hardware. I won't get into because it was a really stupid thing. Anyways.
Okay, well, Apple TV Plus is Apple's Netflix, basically. And so they had an announcement this week that's all of their new shows. And one of them is about Emily Dickinson. It's so that's really the only new news. Like, just an excuse to play that 30 Rock clip,
was
which
that
I
it?
Love.
Also, it's a comedy,
basically,
right?
It's a comedy. It's from Elena Smith, who is a playwright and also formerly wrote on The Newsroom and was like one of the people that got into it with Aaron Sorkin about the terrible campus rape plotline. So she's behind this and she's great. I follow her on Twitter. You should too, at Internet Alina. But yeah, this is one of the many offerings that Apple is going to be putting on their service, which is available for $? That was not part of the announcement. Cool.
We've gone from cable being the terrible aggregator to now the internet being the terrible aggregator. Now that we have 12 streaming services, you know, that you have quality shows spread around on. This service really sounds like it stinks, Phil. The scuttlebutt in all this is that Apple is sort of trying to have their cake and eat it too with all the shows, that they're hiring big talent, but they don't want anything too controversial on their service because of the blowback on their image. So it sounds like all the TV shows that are going to come out of this are going to be kind of neutered. I can't speak to Dickinson, but there's other shows that kind of, you know, there's been people that have left running the show. There's been a lot of sort of whispers and whatnot about how Apple came in. And by Apple, we're talking about people that have no TV background coming in, say, like, don't be so mean. Can't do this. Can't do that. And also they have like 10 shows or something. Like, it's not its own real thing. Like, they may have spent a lot of money on talent, Spielberg and, you know, Witherspoon and blah, blah, blah. But their catalog is still going to be paper thin when mm-hmm. it comes to actually launching. And it kind of feels like their programming, what they're kind of aiming for is some sort of like when it started participant media light, you know,
yeah.
like
yeah.
they got Oprah documentaries, like,
but more toothless.
Yeah. And you want to get asses in the seat for people that are actually subscribing to internet streaming services. Like, you need big shows. You need shows where people's heads come off their bodies and stuff. You know, like, that's what sells. I mean, you know, yeah. like, yeah, sure.
Game of people. Oprahs. Let's do
yeah,
this.
Exactly. No, I mean, you do. I mean, that's what yeah. Amazon said. Like, they did a relook about a year and a half ago and are like, okay, we can continue doing these middling things like Man in the High Castle, but what we really need to do is spend a shitload of money and get our own Game of Thrones type of stuff. And they did. Like, they yep. bought the Lord of the Rings, you know, IP of some sort, and they're doing that. And but Apple, just like, they can't be in this business and be in their own business. Like, yeah. they almost need a label, right? Like, they need to buy a studio and run all their media through that studio that doesn't have the Apple name on it. Otherwise, they're too concerned about their image to actually produce consistently good quality. End of rant.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that Netflix and Amazon had is they had their whole libraries of stuff before they started premiering their own mm-hmm. things.
Right.
So it was like, okay, now they have one thing of their own. Now they have 10 things of their own. Now they have 100. Like, Apple's just starting with these original things. So, like, yeah, who's going to subscribe to a service for, like, literally 10 shows? Like, yeah. I just don't.
And there was a story last week that was about why Netflix is paid like in the high seven figures to keep Friends on for another year, even as fucking Warner Brothers is also about to launch their own streaming service. And it was because the biggest differentiator for people when they're deciding which services to sign up for is what library material they already have. So it's like, what is Apple bringing to the table? Nothing.
And loser of the week.
do we really need another one?
Just for shits and giggles, let's do it.
I mean, I will do this just because it is Caroline, because Supernatural Aww. Is finally ending.
Sorry, Dean girl.
Yeah, the next season, season 15, which actually seemed low to me, will be its last on the CW, which is an interesting phrasing in the headline. Like, it's gonna go to Apple? I doubt it. Also, like, I guess I hadn't seen Jared Padalecki recently. It's time for him to get a big boy haircut. Shit's roof.
Yep. Speaking about rough stuff, do you know what time it is? It's
Jared Padalecki time.
Game time. Boy, this is turning out to be a long season. This is the ninth game time of the current season. To remind you, our scores are Sarah with 4, one victory away from clinching it.
Woo.
Tara with 2 after last week's victory, and Value Guess with 2. Today, we are playing what the author called One Letter Off, but because of recent dictums, we shall now call it If Leaving E is Easy. Thank you, Phil. This game comes from Dave L., who earns himself an extra credit. Topic of his choosing. There are 3 rounds in If Leaving E is Easy, all of which involve identifying TV shows after a one-letter change to its title.
Love these.
In round 1, we drop a letter. In round 2, we add a letter. And in round 3, we change a letter. For example, in round 1, I would read you the following description of the show after dropping the letter, and you give me the new title. Ted Danson punishes Kristen Bell in the afterlife by forcing her to spend eternity training for ultra marathons. Drop one letter for this new show.
The Good Pace?
The Good Pace is correct.
I was thinking The Gold Place, but yeah.
That's how you play it.
Ooh.
All right, so with that in mind, steel mail situation, please, Tara Ariana.
I have 1 steel meal. Everyone else has 0.
All right. That makes it easy. Let's throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. So our order today is Tara, Nick, Sarah. Are we ready to play? Thank you, Phil. Yes. Are you ready, Tara?
Susu Studio.
Mm-hmm. This is round one, dropping a letter.
Yep, got it.
Courtney Cox and Matthew Perry are truly monsters.
Beans.
Nick. Adam Levine, Blake Shelton, and others select the most morally corrupt person from a pool of amateurs they can't see.
Saw this one coming. The Vice.
These are just 1 point each, right?
1 point each, yeah. Everything's one.
Okay, yep.
Juliana Margulies, Sarah, leaves her law practice when she marries into immortality and omnipotence.
The Godwife.
Correct, and that's how you do it. Everybody's got 1 point on their first question. Everybody has two questions left in round one. Tara, this show attempts to prove the existence of extraterrestrials by uncovering eon-old lender claims against all real estate on Earth.
Oh, Ancient Liens.
Oh, nice.
Nick Reinwell-Jones. Not only does Tatiana Maslany have to deal with a new clone sister every week, she's starving and totally bankrupt. Starving, totally bankrupt. Any idea what that show is? Removing a letter. That's Orphan Lack. Orphan Lack.
Okay.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting. Venture capitalists, coders, and CEOs vie for power in the high-stakes, high-tech world of bowling.
Silicon Alley.
Correct. Tara Ariano, this one is one I had to make up just because of numbers. So
okay.
Apologies in advance if it sucks. A Cleveland-based personal assistant and floor manager relocates to Florida to help with the war on drugs.
Oh, no. Cleveland to Florida.
A Cleveland-based personal assistant and floor manager relocates to Florida to help with the war on drugs.
I don't know. The Do Carry Show?
That is Mimi Vice.
Oh.
Oh, wow. All right. So I guess apologies are in order.
In advance.
Yeah. All right. Come on.
No, that's good. I get it.
Okay, Nick. In this steamy after-hours procedural, Rob Estes and Mitzi Capture track a Palm Beach killer inspired by Vlad the Impaler. And if those names don't clue it, you're not going to get it.
True.
I mean, the only one I'm thinking is Silk Stockings, but Silk Stakings.
He did it.
He did it.
Do you know my dad loved that show? What a thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Why? Anyway, sorry.
No problem, Sarah D. Bunting. After a zombie apocalypse, Andrew Lincoln cracks cheesy puns to keep his sons and daughters' spirit up.
Cute. The Walking Dead.
Walking Dead. And that's round one. Tara, the scores, okay. Please.
Oh, okay. Still very close. Nick and I are tied with two each. Sarah has just pulled ahead with three.
All right. That means Tara and Nick. Guess what?
Come on, guys.
You are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Old man Cole's got the card. Here we go. You're working together, and you're splitting the points. So you got 1 point apiece at stake.
We each get 1 point.
Yes.
Got it.
Okay.
Starting with classics, what TV comic often played an archaeologist named Professor Ludwig van Fossil?
I have no idea, so
classics.
I'm going to say... It's got to be someone super old. I don't know. Phil Silvers? Nick, we're playing together. Do you agree?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sid Caesar was the answer.
Duh.
Ugh.
Sitcoms. What was Jim Anderson's job on Father Knows Best?
I have no idea, so I'm going to say architect.
Architect?
Sure,
Nick,
sounds
agree
good.
With that?
Yeah.
He was an insurance salesman. Look, sometimes
Great.
You get good questions, sometimes you don't. Drama.
Sure.
What U.S. river were Rick Marshall and family rafting down when caught in a time vortex in Land of the Lost?
Mississippi.
I believe it's in the song. That's why this question is.
Oh, I don't know. But I don't know the song.
Yeah, I don't know the song either.
All right. Well, name a river.
Mississippi?
Sure.
Rio Grande? What do you think?
I like Mississippi.
Okay.
Colorado. Great. Colorado River. All right. You need all three of these.
Okay. We can do it.
All right. Well, we got this. Yeah.
Kids totally. And games. Mm-hmm. What game show's set was modeled after Burt Reynolds' living room?
Oh, that I actually know this one. It's Win, Lose, or Draw. Yay.
Wow, nice. Wait, nice. Why do you know that?
Because I watched She's it and he was on it all the time. It was on after school. I used to watch that show all the time.
Okay. Yeah, you watched it, but why did you know like it was Burt Reynolds' bedroom?
Well, she's been to Burt Reynolds' living room many times.
He was a co-creator on the show.
Oh, okay. All right. Stars, the answer is a celebrity. Who starred opposite his stepmother, Shirley Jones, in an early 70s music biz sitcom?
Oh.
Wow, I don't know any part of this question.
Who starred opposite his stepmother, Shirley Jones, in an early 70s music biz sitcom?
Oh, David Cassidy? David Cassidy is my guess.
Sure.
Hey! Oh, yeah!
We got all three of them.
No, we still have to get one.
All right, wild card. Do or die.
Oh. Yep.
Okay, all right. I'm feeling good about this.
I knew you were reading ahead. Trying to what guess if we would get
60s,
it.
Okay, what 60s? Okay, you got this, guys. What 60s sitcom did Larry Hagman do before donning his Dallas cowboy hat?
Oh, I Dream of Jeannie.
Yep.
That's how you do it. You squeak it. Got 1 point, which means we're all tied up, right?
Oh, we are all three tied with 2 points.
All right, let's get back to the game proper. This is round two, adding a letter. Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready, Tara?
Yes.
Fed up with local politics in her backwards Indiana town, Amy Poehler takes to burning down government buildings with flint and steel.
Sparks and recreation.
There's a lot of dark ones in round two, which I enjoy.
There were some dark ones in round one, as I recall.
Yeah. I like Dave's tone. Tim Gunn mentors aspiring fashion designers to leave their families and live on the streets.
Project Runaway.
Oh my God.
Sarah D. Bunting. Years of working paycheck to paycheck at a greasy spoon lead Kat Dennings and Beth Bears to inconsolable depression.
Two broken girls. Oh my God.
Back to Tara.
Dave, is everything okay? Other Dave?
Do you need help?
Who hurt you?
If you're in trouble, just say the word Carolina. We'll get to you. Natasha Lyonne dies so many times on her birthday, she becomes wryly amused.
Russian droll.
Correct. Now, this is for you, Nick. Zooey Deschanel navigates single life after a witch's curse turns her into an amphibian.
The Newt Girl.
Sarah Bunting, in a twist that's slightly more believable than the original, Jerry Van Dyke's deceased mother is reincarnated as a talking freshwater fish.
My mother, the carp.
Oh. All right, bring us back to Tara, and I will have to say this is another one of mine, so if it's terrible, you can blame me. Although I have to say I did some research on this one, I'm happy with it. Tara.
Okay.
A tale of law and disorder in a frontier town suffering from xylophobia.
Oh, no. Well, I assume it's Deadwood, but I don't know what it would be. Dreadwood? I don't know.
Xylophobia is the fear of wooden objects.
Oh, okay.
Very now clever, you know. Dave.
Nice, Dave.
Number 17.
Radio.
Thank you. Nick Reinwell Jones. The guests on the Pacific Princess become so gluttonous that even Dr. Bricker can't help them with their abdominal cramps.
The love bloat.
The love bloat. Correct.
Relatable.
Or Sarah. Every season, a group of diverse telegenic 20-somethings are thrown together in a kick-ass apartment where they drink so much they suffer from kidney failure.
The renal world?
All right, this is everybody's last question, round two. This is also one that I created. Standard disclaimers apply. This is for Tara.
Yep.
In 1972, a crack commando unit of fluffy kittens was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These little floof balls promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers for tuna. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, shut up, if no one else can help and you can find them, maybe you can hire...
Oh, no. I know it's the A-Team, but I don't know what you would add. I can't get it. I don't know.
Doesn't know. Nobody's got steel mills, but anybody want to take a crack at that one?
The A-Team.
The A-Team.
Oh.
Well, all right. Well done, Dave.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good.
This is for Nick. I had to rework this one, so standard disclaimers apply. Okay. Mike Coulter plays an indestructible whale in this tale about protecting Harlem from those who krill.
Oh, Jesus.
Mike Coulter plays an indestructible whale in this tale about protecting Harlem from those who krill.
Is it Fluke Cage?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
All right, taking us into our second score break, the end of round two, for Sarah D. Bunting. A young woman gains the ability to slay demons in addition to winning poker hands with shitty cards.
Bluffy the Vampire Slayer?
You are correct, and that is round two. Tara, scores, please. God.
All right, well, still very close. Nick and Sarah are now tied with 7 points each. I have 6 due to fucking up the awe team.
All right, that means Tara, you are in. The Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone.
Come on, Tara.
We know the drill. Here you go.
Okay.
Classics. What 50s series was shot in a replica of the Los Angeles Police Department first floor?
Dragnet?
Oh.
Hey!
Sitcoms. Whose death on the Mary Tyler Moore Show sent the WJM crew into helpless laughter? It's in the canon.
It's the clown. Yeah, was his name Chuckles? Oh, nice. Shit.
Drama. Mm-hmm. What space show's pilot featured Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike?
No. Star Trek, the original series.
All right. So you got 3. If you get the next 3, you double your output. Kids and Games. Okay. What letter is the owl named for on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
O?
X. And so it's that, but you got your 2 points. So I do believe that puts you in the lead, correct?
Yes, I am now ahead by 1 point.
All right. We are now in round 3. This is the biggest round. There's tons of questions. So this is still anybody's game.
This is switching a letter.
We're changing one letter. We're not adding. We're not dropping. We're simply changing one letter.
Changing. Got it.
Here we go, Tara.
We're going through changes.
Bea Arthur and Betty White star as retired mermaids.
Oh. Oh, no. Oh, the Golden Gills.
Are correct. Nick Reinwell-Jones, your first change of letter question. The staff of an army hospital in the Korean War deal with stress by dancing wildly to metal and punk music.
Mosh.
Would watch.
In this campy reality show, Sarah, contestants quickly smuggle cocaine across the border under giant wigs and padded butts.
Also would watch RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yep.
Correct. Back to Tara. Coach Sue Sylvester turns violent after listening to one too many show tunes. Rachel and Finn have to run for their lives.
Oh, well, it's Glee. What do you change the letter to?
Rachel and Finn have to run for their lives.
Yeah. Ooh, I don't know.
That's a little show we call Flea.
Oh, of course.
Back to Nick. Jessica Sarah Parker stars as an awkward nerd who becomes...
Sarah Jessica Parker.
What'd I say?
Jessica Sarah. Sarah Parker. It's okay.
A non-union Canadian equivalent.
All right, everybody. How about y'all shut up? Sarah Jessica Parker stars as an awkward nerd who becomes popular after inventing rectangular beer containers for high school parties.
Square kegs.
Correct. Nice. Sarah D. Bunting, a British expat, summarizes the latest news, then just sobs uncontrollably into the camera. British expat.
Last Weep with John Oliver.
Wait, sorry. Say that again. I dinged you all over the place there. Answer again, please, Sarah.
It's the Last Weep with John Oliver.
Right? Close. Really? That's Last Weep Tonight, John. Close, really? But no cigar. Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Dick Wolf produces yet another spinoff from The Flagship, this time set in the NYPD K-9 unit. Two possible answers here.
Oh, okay. I'm drawing a blank. I'm sorry.
Anybody want to guess? I have two answers provided by Mr. Dave L. They are Paw and Order.
Oh.
Or, if you care, Lab and Order.
Okay, sure.
Nick, an inventor raises his robot as a daughter whose true identity is almost discovered when her machinery starts to give off incredibly pungent gases.
Smell wonder.
Would watch.
Sarah D. Bunting, failing to take her religious orders seriously, Sally Field is punished with eternal hellfire.
Failing to take her... The frying nun?
The frying nun.
Nice.
All right, Tara. Yes. Larry David develops a drug that guarantees he will never be optimistic again.
Okay. It's Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Larry David develops a drug that guarantees he will never be optimistic again. Let me reread that for you, because I think that's a little misleading, okay?
Okay.
Larry David develops a drug that guarantees he will never suffer from the disease of optimism again.
I got nothing. Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Cure Your Enthusiasm. Nick.
I was going to say that's already kind of redundant to the premise of the show, but.
Or Nick. Turns out all those English, Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Irish desserts were made from smoke and mirrors. Turns out.
Oh, the Great British Baking, a faking show. The Great British Fake Off?
Yeah, that's one. I guess the other one's acceptable too.
It's what it's called on Netflix.
All right. Well done. You got that one. Sarah D. Bunting, drunk with power. Robin Wright drives up the federal deficit, stockpiling curdled dairy products in the Oval Office.
Can you read the last part? Stockpiling what now?
Curdled dairy products in the Oval Office. It's right there. It's staring in the face.
House of curds?
Yeah, sure.
Could have had a Curb Your Enthusiasm on, too.
I'd watch either of those.
Lisa Welchel and Kim Fields are plagued by flatulence and terrible puns about the name Tootie.
Of course they are, in The Farts of Life.
Nick Reinwell Jones. Actor Aziz Ansari gives up on dating in New York City to focus on his ice cream business.
Master of Cone.
Correct. Last question before we'll take a quick score break. This is not the last question of the game. Sarah D. Bunting claiming he wants to go to film school. James Vanderbeek secretly installs cameras in the locker rooms of his small seaside town.
Ew. Oh, Dawson's Creep?
Yeah.
Ew.
All right. That is... Everybody's got three questions left with his scores.
All right. Very close game. Nick has 12 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 11 points. I have 10 points.
All right. Guess what, Tara? You're back. And the Roseworth Equalizer Challenge. So, classics. Who often said you rang on the many loves of Dobie Gillis? It is not Lurch.
Maynard G. Krebs.
What?
What?
How the fuck do you even know who?
Literally, the only thing I know about that show is played by the guy who played Gilligan, Bob Denver.
Oh, sitcoms. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who spends his vacations at the YMCA in Charlotte on the Andy Griffith Show?
One of two possible answers.
Vacations at the YMCA.
Yeah. Gomer Pyle. The Don Knotts guy whose name I couldn't remember.
Yeah, Barney Fife. That was right.
Ah, that's it.
Drama. What 1990-91 show sees suspects arrested in its first half hour and tried in its second?
Law and Order.
That is an adorable little piece of history there.
Lab and Order.
All right. Kids and Games.
Yep.
What Dudeville character was replaced by Papoose Gina Running Water?
That's all extremely offensive. I have no idea what any of that means.
Me either. The answer is Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Apologies to the Indigenous community.
First Nations community.
Stars.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So you still need one of these, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Stars. What part Cherokee Indian became the most famous
televangelist
from Ada, Oklahoma? Boy, let me read that again.
So, can I just answer? Is it Jimmy Swaggart?
Oral Roberts. I really wanted to edit that so I had a clean pronunciation, but I guess that's not happening.
Sorry.
Welcome to my world, people. What Get Smart song won the 1957 $64,000 question for her knowledge of Shakespeare?
Oh, it's the lady, and I don't know her name.
It is correct. It's Barbara Belden.
Of course.
Well, you didn't get it, but there's still questions in the real game, starting with this one.
Okay. Yep.
Still on the change of letter shtick. Grant Gustin fights crime by getting naked very, very quickly.
The Flash. I mean, Nick, the Flash works, actually.
You can't change an A to an A.
No, you can't.
Jennifer Gardner leaves her career as an international spy to become a terrible opera diva.
That's for me?
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm a terrible opera.
Harry the Three.
I have no idea.
Anybody?
Arias.
Correct.
Oh.
Sarah, you're so smart.
As far as mental imagery goes, I think this is my favorite of the game.
Oh, God. Okay.
Edie Falco loses her hospital job for swiping Percocet and tries to restart her career in Oslo.
Tries to restart. Oh, wow. Norse Jackie.
I'm just imagining her in the show Vikings during all that.
Yep. Lots of braids.
Back to Tara. Mm-hmm. Ever since one of the actors left the show to become a actual freaking real life princess, the remaining cast have felt like number twos.
Oh no. It's Suits.
Number twos.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't get there.
In Tara's defense.
You just said it.
Shits.
Pardon?
Shits.
Say it once again so I can hear it.
Shits.
There you go.
Just leave that anywhere.
Nick Reinwell Jones.
I look forward to hearing that as a future drop. Shits.
Say it again.
We are all tied up, by the way.
Oh, time for another tar update.
Shits. All right, Nick.
Punchy.
All right, everybody shut up now. Charlie Cox plays a blind vigilante who never wears a costume. He hangs out with the Flash a lot, I think.
Bear Devil?
Yeah, Bear Devil. Yeah.
A lot of naked superheroes in this.
Sarah D. Bunting. Claire Foy can't handle the pressure of the monarchy and plunges in desperation into the Thames. Talk it out. It might help you.
Okay, well, it's the Crown. I have one of those things in my head, which is obviously is not this, but I keep thinking it's the prawn. Is that the prawn? It's the drown.
It's the drown.
Yeah,
but I really wish it was the prawn. I don't know what the hell that would be, but I'm interested in watching. Oh my god.
Like a teeny little prawn like inching through the river with a teeny little prawn.
Yeah. The prawn is not amused, etc. Alright, Tara, scores please.
Season 2, it's a crawdad.
Oh, no.
Okay, still close. Sarah and Nick now tied with 13 each. I have 12.
Alright, so mathematically anybody can still end up on top. Everybody has one question, which is what I call a question.
Another good
guys, everybody, just look.
Yep.
Don't remove your Patreon support just because today is so punchy. We'll be back in forum next week, I promise.
Tara, we're doing Ariana, our best. Yes.
Rebelling against his intrusive therapist mom, Asa Butterfield makes money teaching his UK schoolmates about the dark arts.
Hex Education.
You are correct.
Would watch.
We are currently tied.
Yep.
Nick, to pull ahead. Sandra Oh plays an MI5 officer chasing a dangerous murderer with a literal death stare.
Killing Eye.
Yeah.
Correct. All right. Sarah's nice. Got to get this to tie the game up. A hedonistic vacation escape is threatened by robots and plagues of locusts. Robots. Hedonistic vacation. Robots. Locusts.
Robots.
Locusts. I want to say fantasy insect, but that's not correct. Hedonistic vacation.
Yeah.
Is threatened by robots and plagues of locusts. I don't think I know this.
Don't, but I think other people do. It is.
I don't know.
Oh, they don't know. Okay. Tara, do you know?
Yeah, I'm not going to use my steel meal for it. Well,
but just let people know the game is over.
It's Pest World.
Pest World. Pest World is the answer. All right. Official end of game scores, please, Tara.
All right. Well, that leaves us with me and Sarah tied with 13 each, and Nick is our victor with 14.
Nick! Well done, Nick. All right. I have a tiebreaker. We will turn into a steel meal. And as steel meals are becoming very important in this late season game.
Could have used a couple.
Please don't answer until I have fully read the clue.
Okay.
We are changing a letter still. Are we ready?
Yes.
Descending into madness, Queen Cersei forces large groups of peasants from King's Landing to kill each other for sport.
Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones is correct.
Oh,
you win the points, you win the game, you won everything.
Nice work.
Well done, Nick.
Valued guest.
Valued guest.
Nice. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra. Hot great. We sunk our teeth into the TV adaptation of What We Do in the Shadows before going around the dial where Tara decimated the village, Nick played house with Parnum and St. Clair, Sarah fought the good fight, and Dave decided to get Kraken this time. We celebrated Tara's tiny, unprovable psychic taskmaster idea's triumph. And her triumph getting Frasier's The Matchmaker into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Nick, playing for value guests, was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
named her Emily Dickinson,
Sarah D. Bunting,
vampire comments only,
and Nick Reinwell Jones.
Tim Cook censors it, so it's Emily Bleepinson.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time, right here. Extra Hot Great.
What a fucking disaster.
At least we have the virgins.